this week's 51%. With Election Day around the corner, we take a look at women's political clout. A history professor dissects the Kavanaugh hearings from a certain angle.
Kavanaugh is saying, I have always been a good Catholic. How could I do such things?
And a poet talks about sexuality, disability, and more. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. This election cycle is being billed as another year of the woman, with a record number of female candidates running for office. Despite increasing representation in Congress, however, some research suggests women have less political clout now than in the 1950s. From the Ways and Means podcast, here's Carol Jackson.
In 1972, when she was 31, Pat Schroeder's husband convinced her to run for a House seat in Colorado. At this time, women made up less than 3% of Congress. There wasn't even a woman on Schroeder's local school board.
Every media person would say to me, how could you be a congresswoman and a mother? And I got through about 40 of those questions. And on the 41st, I think I said, I have a brain and I have a uterus and they both work.
Schroeder ran on anti-Vietnam War platform, and she won. She spent the next quarter century in Congress. Women now make up 20% of Congress, and there are hundreds of female elected officials serving in political office across the country. But Duke University researcher Kristen Goss says even with this increased representation, women as a political group are less powerful now than they were in the 1950s.
They had a lot of political clout. You know, women voted, and they were organized in every congressional district. So members of Congress were actually listening to what these women's groups were doing.
Goss's research shows, contrary to popular belief, women in the 1950s were not tied by their apron strings to their stoves. During World War II, many of them did go to work, think Rosie the Riveter. After the war, many women in America joined local and national groups and were actively supporting causes they cared about.
Things like international relations, poverty, health, juvenile justice. All sorts of issues that you wouldn't normally think of as quote-unquote women's issues.
But as women became more independent and started working outside the home, they had less time. Large groups like the League of Women Voters and the General Federation of Women's Clubs and the American Association of University Women shed members and, in turn, political leverage. Without these groups backing them, female politicians lost a certain degree of clout.
So if you have, you know, a token woman in some position of power, she's not necessarily going to feel comfortable advocating for some of the perspectives or concerns that women as a group might share. She might actually be penalized for that.
Schroeder, who left Washington in 1997, says women are sorely needed in today's government. She remembers being criticized in the late 80s for crying in a speech while she toyed with the idea of running for president.
It seemed to be great if men did it. If men did it, it showed compassion and sensitivity and all these wonderful things. If women did it, and then it was like, oh my word, she's having a breakdown. This is just terrible. I can't believe it.
Schroeder supports a Florida group called Ruth's List. It's a network of women who help Democratic women get elected to local and state office. She says if anybody is going to pick up the nuclear phone, she wants it to be somebody who understands the humanity of the decision and is capable of crying about it. I'm Carol Jackson of the Ways and Means Podcast.
The Ways and Means Podcast is produced by Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. Justice Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation to the Supreme Court has a history professor in New York reflecting upon the role of male privilege and entitlement. Vassar College's Dr. Meeta Chowdhury is an expert on sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. I spoke with her about the correlation she saw at play during the Kavanaugh hearings. Dr. Christine Blasey Ford accused Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her more than 30 years ago. Kavanaugh denied it and is now on the high court. Professor Chowdhury says the pages of history show that masculinized privilege and entitlement are common threads used to silence accusations of sexual assault.
The thing that really struck me, and this comes from my research, is Kavanaugh's Catholicism, that part of his sort of self-defense in that testimony he gave on the 27th was how he was this virtuous Catholic boy. And what really struck me is he was educated in a Jesuit institution in the early 80s, which was really the beginning of a kind of American Catholic conservatism, right? It's the beginning of John Paul II. And the Jesuits also kind of embody a Catholic masculinity. And here's what struck me as the connection, a kind of structural, systematic connection, is thinking back to, for example, all the revelations that have come up about the Catholic Church, priests in the Catholic Church over the last several decades, is the impunity with which so many actions took place, right? And that part of it, what made it possible, is how both the men involved and those who trusted them saw them as exalted human beings, you know, that they were the conduits of God. And how was it possible that somebody who held such a position could commit such crimes? And what I see is an echo of that in Kavanaugh's statements, in that his Catholic virtue, you know, which was expressed in very, you know, very external forms, you know, very visible forms, you know, his acts of charity, his attendance at church, et cetera, et cetera. So he's visibly very Catholic. And that created a kind of impunity and raised him above a bar of accountability. And so in that sense, I think that there's a kind of way in looking at these instances and connecting them is to understand the nature of that sense of privilege and entitlement, where it comes from. You know, it's not simply white male entitlement, but it's also how there are different institutions that support that kind of entitlement. And so my thinking is that Kavanaugh also grew up surrounded by educators who in some sense saw themselves above certain forms of accountability. And again, if you return to the early days when accusations were being made against priests of the church, the initial response was, how is this possible? That was the church's defense, that these are men of God. How could they do that? And again, Kavanaugh is saying, I have always been a good Catholic. How could I do such things?
She says the priesthood is inherently masculine. Kavanaugh attended a private all-boys Jesuit high school.
How, you know, after, say, elementary school, certainly when he was in high school, how many women did he have teach him? You know, the only authority figures he knew in some ways were men.
She says Kavanaugh, in part, seemingly absolved himself of the accusations per his Catholicism.
There was a sizable segment of his statement that really kept pointing back to his Catholicism. And the way in which he essentially performs his Catholicism, so it's visible for everybody to see. And so, in a sense, how dare you question me given how I appear? You know, I am this good Catholic. And therefore, automatically, I should be absolved from this.
She says it is the power of institutions that supports perpetrators and creates mindsets and attitudes. Choudhury believes that seeing connections between a current movement and the Catholic Church would be enlightening.
And I actually do think there are connections to be made, but more connections that need to be made between the Me Too movement and what happened with the Catholic Church, because these are questions about power.
In her book, The Wanton Jesuit and the Wayward Saint, Choudhury investigates a scandalous 1731 trial in which a 21-year-old woman accused her Jesuit confessor of seduction, heresy, abortion, and bewitchment. She is now starting a book on sexual assault and violence in the Catholic Church in 17th and 18th century France. Professor Choudhury teaches early modern Europe and old regime France, specializing in gender and sexuality at Poughkeepsie-based Vassar College. Next year, Albany, New York will host a 6-day international sporting competition and entertainment festival, and all the athletes will be women. 51%'s Dave Lucas reports.
Female athletes from the United States and all around the world will gather in Albany for the Aurora Games, inspired by the Olympics and named in honor of the Roman goddess of the dawn. Speaking Monday, Aurora Games creator and executive producer Jerry Solomon says it's a slate of sports competitions.
What we want to do is have a festival that is going to extend from the streets out there through the arena up into the convention center, and we're going to celebrate women's sports like it's never been celebrated before. So with that, I'm happy to announce that we're going to be bringing the Aurora Games August 20th to the 25th, 2019, right here to Albany to the Times Union Center.
Alongside the competition will be a festival celebrating women in entertainment, the arts, business, and culture. Aurora Games Advisory Board member Donna DeVerona is a former Olympic swimming gold medalist and ABC sports journalist.
We found out that 94% of women that make it in the higher echelons in the C-suite as CEOs, CFOs, COOs have had a sports background, and 50% who competed in college. So what does that say about the sport experience? There is a direct correlation. It's about leadership and about taking our place as businesswomen and functioning in our culture. And you know what? We're the envy of the world. So it's important that we are the first to do the Aurora Games next August, to welcome the world to come here and see, after 40-some years of work, of breaking down doors and prejudice, what sport can do on the field of play, because you never know where sports can take you.
Solomon says the Games conducted a nationwide search, finally settling on the TU Center.
We needed to go to a building that had the capability to turn over from one sport to the next, to the next, to the next, over a six-day period, and we knew that that could be done here.
County Executive Dan McCoy is hoping the Games will make Albany home for good.
We also want to promote athletes in Albany County to enhance the vision by featuring women in arts, culture, education, entertainment throughout the event. And that's what we want to add to the Aurora Games, to give an opportunity to people here just locally.
To date, 15 countries have signed up to participate in the Games, which are to be held every 2 years. Tickets will go on sale Friday, March 8th, International Women's Day. For 51%, I'm Dave Lucas.
Donna DeVerona, the former Olympic swimming gold medalist sports journalist who you just heard in this story, says Aurora includes games that had been absent for some time in the Olympics.
None of those sports existed in the Olympics when I went to my first two. Basketball wasn't added till 1976, and that was a struggle. If you think about it, women's marathon wasn't added till 84. If you think about it, women's soccer, or football, as we know internationally, wasn't added until the Atlanta Games. Women's ice hockey didn't happen till Nagano. So, and that didn't just happen by accident. That happened because women had a united voice. And we went to Washington and we lobbied our congressmen and senators. We formed organizations like the Women's Sports Foundation, and we met people face to face. But again, that's not the only reason why I've been so passionate about sports. Research shows that women that play sport are less likely to be in abusive relationships, more likely to reach for higher education, more likely in the job market to reach higher echelons. And just this last few years, I worked on a program to help women transition from elite sport into business.
Donna DeVerona also is Aurora Games Advisory Board member. We now welcome back to the show Dr. Sharon Ufberg with her 51% segment, Force of Nature. She interviews Susan Flora, who has a history in international educational publishing. Flora started her own company 10 years ago, Word Teasers, and the idea began with Flora's need to help her then 16-year-old son improve his vocabulary and performance on the SATs. The result was SAT Vocabulary, the first in a series of interactive card games that challenge players with questions to get everyone talking, laughing, and learning. Ufberg asked Flora why she decided to create Word Teasers.
Well, you know, they say that invention is, or necessity is the reason for everything. And in this case, it was the reason why I created the company. My son was studying for SATs, but he was dyslexic and had a lot of trouble. He could memorize anything he read, but he had a lot of trouble understanding that word in context. So I figured there had to be a fun way to help him learn these words. And as a mom, you do whatever you can to try to help your child. So I created a series of just fun cards. They were actually sentences on index cards that we would do at the dinner table, and we'd ask each other questions, and his dad would ask questions, and his brother would ask questions, and we started laughing and talking. And along the way, we discovered that he had actually learned the words and their meaning. So that was how the company was born.
So, you know, as a 50-year-old woman, you know, why was starting a business like this particularly meaningful for you? You had a long career in corporate, you know, educational publishing. Why at 51 did you decide to just go in and start something entrepreneurial and new?
That's a great question. Actually, when I was 39 years old, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And as you can imagine, that kind of rocked my world as well as my family's world. I fortunately am a survivor and survived a pretty grueling episode with that, but I came to understand that there was a lot more in life that I wanted to do beyond just working for a company. And I really dreamed of having something that I could do, be my own boss, come up with all my own creative ideas and pursue it the way I wanted to pursue it, but still have time to spend with my family. So when I came up with this idea for my son, people would come over to our house and say, wow, what a great idea. You really should publish that. You should do something with it. And all of a sudden the light bulb went on and I thought, aha, this is it. And that's what prompted me to do it. It also was a time in my life where my kids were growing up. One was going off to college, the one studying for SATs, the other one was filing right behind it. So I often think of this as the new baby in the house that kept me motivated and interested and just engaged with the world.
Yeah, such a fabulous way of giving back, you know, too, and helping others who, oh, I'm sure, were in your same situation. You know, now that the company is about 10 years old, I know you have 15 different games now. It's expanded well beyond the SAT vocabulary game. What's on the horizon for Word Teasers? And, you know, how are people using the games that you're making?
Well, on the horizon are always new games. I'm fascinated by sort of quirky information, so I'm always looking for something new that I want to explore personally. I think if you like what you're writing about or you're having your writers write about, then you're going to embrace it and it's going to be easier to sell. And I think that people like these little sound bites, nuggets of information, so you never know what's going to turn up next. It might be another edition of American Trivia or Cool and Fascinating Facts. I think what really inspires me the most is the way my customers or the people that bought the games come back to me and tell me how much they liked playing with it. I got a letter from someone the other day who took the time to write to me to tell me how she uses the game. And apparently what she does, she's bought several of them, and she has started doing things with her granddaughters to get them to understand how important it is to volunteer. And they live in upstate Vermont somewhere. I don't know exactly where. And they take a couple of my trivia games and visit nursing homes and sit and talk to a lot of the residents that may not have people coming to visit them. And she said what's so fun is that it gets the residents who may not be too communicative to start talking and reminiscing and laughing. And she said it's taught her grandchildren just a whole new appreciation of the elderly. And I thought, wow, isn't that a cool thing? Huh? I'm so inspired that that's how these games inspired somebody to use them. I also have a kindergarten teacher who wrote to me and said that she uses, believe it or not, the SAT edition with her kindergarten kids. And she said, you know, kids can learn big words. We just don't teach them. So she has her big word of the week and works all week on one word from the edition to get the kids to use it, to understand it, to be able to spell it. And then they come home and they impress their parents. I find that just so creative and fun, and wish that one of my kids had been in a class like that. So,
Me too. And I feel like, you know, there's one of the things that's so fantastic is that it's, you know, it's not an app. It's not on their phones that they actually talk to one another, that they have a card that they actually are sitting at the dinner table. Or, you know, I think we're all looking for ways where we can interact with our families face to face again. And I just think, you know, Word Teasers really provides that.
I agree, Sharon. I think that the art of conversation is something that we're losing. And I think that we're all understanding that we're losing it, and we have to figure out a way to bring that back to the dinner table and put our phones down. I've actually even had a couple retailers suggest that I create some signs that say this is a game that's a no phone zone. And I think that's really important that we, no matter what age we are, that we can all engage and talk to each other and have fun in the process and probably learn something too.
Exactly. Well, Susan, thanks so much for taking the time to come and speak with us today. If you want to know more about Word Teasers, you can go on to their website, wordteasers.com. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That's the right one. And Susan Flora, thank you so much for being with me. This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in California. Idina Burke ignores the haters who tell her what to do. The artist does her own thing, spoken word, along with essays and poems on disability and sexuality. KFAI's Dixie Treichel reports.
I'm disabled, queer, and Jewish, and so that all intertwines with the work that I do. I was in a basement punk band. Then I quickly got back into poetry. My first poetry book took 3.5 years to write. It's called A Bird's Eye. I kind of wanted to have people listen to spoken word a little bit more. And if you listen closely enough, poetry is music and music is poetry. And so I considered myself, and I'm using this as a reclamatory word, a crippled punk rock poet, because that's the mesh of all of my identities.
You say I shouldn't be angry. Instead, grateful to God for the lessons held by the hands of man who taught me nothing but that we can be hateful. I'm not the wounds of your mother. Thick with salt, heavy breathing, misplaced, bitter, coffee-stained papers. Voices beneath the floorboards rising toward the ceiling, but anger lives here. In the screams you dared to silence, anger lives here, and I choose to grant her a home.
I recently did a book on disability and sexuality. It's called Wheelchairs, Whips, and Bondage Tape. And it's starting a life-saving dialogue. It's saving lives, which is essentially what I want to do. It's a collection of essays and poetry, conversation starters that I don't really want to end. I speak purely from my experience. I do not speak for all of disabled people. We all have various opinions, and there's so much shutting down of sexuality and so much denial of sexual identity and so much ableism within the queer community that we really need to talk about inclusive spaces. Not just demand inclusiveness, but demand safety.
Of mangled teeth and flesh, of swallowing every hurtful wave that dare to try and drag me to shore. Let me feast on my anger, gnawing on the flesh from insults from those who dare to tell me that I am not enough. Let me spit into the eyes of media that mockingly calls itself my reflection.
And the Hatbox Collective is a journey of my Judaism and going through that and really tapping back into music again, because I helped write the music for that as well. It's just dipping my toe into the music industry again after being told by a lot of ableist people that I didn't have the capability to sing or to write or compose, dedicating certain things to heartache and the loss of my grandmother, who was a Holocaust survivor.
I wonder if you can see the skeleton behind these eyes, or if my self-doubt somehow flared your lens. I crawl back in the caskets nailed with times before and after us. My grandmother knows no number or name they'd left before she was presented with one. And we made generational leaps, or rather setbacks, when you wanted to call me yours. The underbelly of Woeful Song keeps calling me, hesitant of you. And though I am afraid, I will sing. And though I am afraid, I will sing.
That was poet-artist Idina Burke. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1527.